Hello, and welcome to another edition of Brussels Sprouts. I'm Andrea Kindle-Taylor.
And I'm Jim Townsend.
And I'm Carissa Nitschi.
And we're so glad you can join us. We are in, I would say, the heat of election season here in the United States, and there's really been no shortage of reporting on Russian attempts to interfere in the 2020 election. And really, it's been ongoing since 2016 that Russian efforts have continued. Their tactics are evolving, and there is a concerted effort to undermine the candidacy of Vice President Biden and to erode Americans' faith in democratic institutions. And so here on Brussels Sprouts, we wanted to jump into this topic, and we thought that there would be no one better to do it with us than Nina Yankowitz, who has, as I will tee up in a second, written a new book on disinformation, How to Lose the Information War, Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. And Nina is perfect because not only is she an expert on disinformation here in the United States, but in that book, she looks at disinformation in five European countries as well. So she is the perfect transatlanticist to be able to guide us through this conversation. So welcome, Nina.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be with you all.
And really just a little bit more on her bio. Nina is a research fellow at the Wilson Center Science and Technology Innovation Program. And I just wanted to plug that in addition into her great new book on how to lose the information war, she also published a piece with CNES in Carrie Cordero's series on election integrity called The Growing Threat of Domestic Disinformation in Poland. So we're definitely going to be able to pull on some of those threads in our discussion. But what I wanted to do is maybe start here on the US front first and talk about Russian interference here in the United States. It's obviously become such a heavily politicized issue. But as your book highlights, it's not exclusive to the United States. The Kremlin has been conducting these campaigns across Europe for as long, and probably even longer in some of the key Baltics, Ukraine, where they use these as testing grounds for a lot of their tactics. This has been happening for some time. But I would love just to hear, as you've looked at it in Europe, as you understand it in the United States, How do you think about some of the similarities that you see across the Atlantic, and if there are any key differences between what the United States is or what Russia is doing in the United States versus in Europe?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the key similarity is that Russia's really good at identifying societal fissures in each of these places to amplify and exploit. And that's a key misconception about how disinformation works writ large. It's not just about creating quote unquote fake news. In fact, it's hardly ever fake, cut and dry fake. It's stuff that people have real grievances about. And those issues are taken and then amplified, whether that's through inauthentic amplification, through, you know, ads and things like that, or through organic amplification by identifying existing communities online where they can make these things really trend without purchasing a single ad or, you know, without using a troll or bot army. I think a key difference is that Europe is very aware of these problems, is trying to work against them, and we are very slow off the starting block here in the United States. I think until 2016, and even you could argue for several years after, the social media platforms and the U.S. government really did not recognize the threat and understand how severe it is, and I would argue the U.S. government still hasn't done that. While the Europeans have been regulating social media, they have been creating, you know, counter-disinformation programs that are whole of government and whole of society, investing in things like societal resilience in places like Finland and Sweden, even Ukraine and Estonia have been doing that sort of thing for a long time. And that means that we are very much not the leader in this space. In fact, I would say in almost every space, whether it's regulatory in the private sector or in the government sector, we've kind of abdicated our responsibility and our leadership as the United States in these areas. And that's very worrisome to me, because when that vacuum is left open, what happens is not only do our adversaries say, okay, it's open season in the information space, but it also means that we have kind of a patchwork regulatory response, and we don't have that community of democracies pushing back against our adversaries. Instead, we have, you know, Germany with its NetzDG law, which is probably the most democratic of all the counter-disinformation laws, but has still inspired some authoritarian action and copycat laws in places like Singapore and Russia. And, you know, we have some good patchwork responses, but it's not what it could be if we were all working together.
One of the challenges too, and I definitely want to talk a little bit more about what we need to do moving forward to address the challenge, but it's been really interesting to watch, maybe spend a little more time on the diagnostics front, really interesting to watch how Russian tactics have evolved since 2016. Some of them are tried and true and are persistent, but there have been some differences that we're seeing now compared to what we saw in 2016. So can you tell us a little bit about how you think the Kremlin is updating and adapting, and how much of that is in response to early steps the United States has done? Have they seen some of these early initiatives or things that we've done in our own domestic space and then adapted to respond and to skirt those initiatives?
Yeah, so I think the platforms, although they were really late to start recognizing the problem, the fact that they've cracked down on the inauthentic amplification, the networks of bots and trolls that were used a lot in 2016, has been a detriment to the types of activities that we saw in 2016. But the Kremlin in particular is really good at information laundering. So it doesn't need that inauthentic amplification. What instead it's doing, and we saw this with the recent peace data takedown, this takedown that the FBI tipped Facebook and Twitter off about. It was related to the Internet Research Agency. And basically what they were doing is creating a website and hiring actual American freelance journalists to write for that website. Then putting those links in pretty large left-leaning Facebook groups. And then those just took off, you know, without the purchase of a single ad. I think they maybe bought about $400 worth of ads, but most of the amplification that they achieved was organic amplification. And that's the sort of thing that we're seeing more and more these days, rather than those large networked inauthentic efforts. And that makes sense, because when an authentic American voice is the one that's amplifying disinformation, it gets much harder to crack down on, unless it's something in terms of the tactics that's networked or against terms of service. If it's just a bunch of individuals, which groups and the structure of groups are primed to encourage people to engage that way, it's really hard to draw that line. And I think that's what we're struggling with now today. And of course, it has to be said, you know, we're doing a great job for the Kremlin, creating a lot of our own division. Certainly we're more polarized and antagonistic than ever before. And there's very little that the Kremlin has to do. It doesn't have to create new narratives. It just has to hone in on ones that are already so prevalent in American society.
One question that people love to debate and discuss is kind of like how, so getting into the response piece, how to respond. So how, and people will make the argument that of course the Kremlin has continued unabated doing these things because they haven't paid significant costs, or the costs haven't been so high that the Kremlin has been willing to change its behavior. And I guess I would love to hear how you think about that. Do you think this is an issue that, like, if we could just make it too costly for the Kremlin to continue to do these things, that we could actually change their calculus and their willingness to engage in this? So how much of the response needs to be on that front, and how much of the response needs to actually be maybe recognizing that we have limited ability to change the Kremlin's calculus and focusing on ways that we can mitigate the impact or the effectiveness of their tactics? How do you think about that kind of spectrum of response?
Yeah, so in the European countries that I think have a better understanding and a better strategy to counter the threat, they've balanced both of them. They, you know, have set a red line for the Kremlin and imposed costs. Of course, these are smaller nations, so when they impose costs, it doesn't necessarily have the same effect that the United States might in that regard. But I do think one shortcoming of the Trump administration's policies, you know, you'll hear the Trump administration officials say over and over, nobody's been tougher on Russia than President Trump. And if you look at the policy responses, sanctions on individuals involved with the Internet Research Agency, some oligarchs, it looks like it might be true. And then you look at what President Trump does himself, and he's joking with Putin about fake news and journalists and freedom of the press, those sorts of things. And that totally undercuts that policy because, you know, it doesn't matter what the consequences are for Putin. He's got his buddy, President Trump, who's saying it's all okay. And it really presents a dilemma in terms of, you know, what is the actual US policy right now on Russian disinformation? And we also hear, of course, President Trump undermining the international, the intelligence community on a regular basis with their assessments about this. So I think we need a clear communication strategy coming from any U.S. government. And I think the costs do need to be raised a little bit because these are very low cost, but high return on investment operations. And clearly the costs that have been imposed so far aren't enough. Now, that being said, we could sanction Russia to Timbuktu and back, and there would still be other vulnerabilities for other adversaries to exploit. And that's why we really do need to think about a whole of society approach. I know, groan, everyone hates that term, right? But the nations that have been able to successfully push back on this have looked at the fissures that are being exploited in their societies, like in Estonia, the ethnic fissures between ethnic Russians and ethnic Estonians, the economic gap between those two parties, the education gap, all of these things. They've invested in media literacy. They've invested in public broadcasting in the Russian language. And a lot of these same strategies can be invested in here. I mean, I don't need to tell this group that we need to spend more on constructing an information space that is trustworthy for people. And we spend about $3 per person per year on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For democracy, I just think that's abysmal, especially as we go around to places like Ukraine and tell them how important the public broadcaster is, right? So I think there are a lot of investments that we need to make. And then we also need to send a clear signal in terms of imposing costs. It's two sides of the same coin.
So let me take this to a more basic on the street level, if I can. And as our readership, which is now pretty big, I have to say.
Listenership.
Well, some read the transcripts. They ask me and I send them a transcript, but no. You know, when you turn on your computer in this day and age, where a lot of us are seeing, you know, some strange things pop up, how would you describe to our listeners what looks like something that comes from Russia and what is just a nutcase down the street who has sent something that someone else has retweeted? And, you know, it doesn't say made in Russia on the bottom of it, but what would you tell our listeners would look at and say, yeah, that looks like something that comes out of Russia? Do you have to be really deep into it to see that kind of thing, or is it pretty obvious to anyone that it's a Russian sourced thing?
So it depends, and I know that's not a satisfying answer. The sort of troll and bot accounts that were really popular in 2016, as I said before, are less prevalent now. They were the types that had, you know, an egg picture, or you could reverse image search the picture, and it was clearly stolen from like a hairstyle magazine or something like that. They might have had an automatically generated username with a lot of letters and numbers, but that is becoming less and less the case. In fact, in the peace data operation that I referenced before, the fake profiles that Russia made to represent their editors were actually not even just stolen images. They used AI to alter the images so that they wouldn't have a hit in a reverse image search. So they're getting a lot more clever. Now, that being said, I think everybody has a responsibility to just do what I've been calling informational distancing. If you feel yourself getting emotional about a piece of content, either like that is ludicrous and it's clearly a crazy piece of content and it leaves you wondering if it's a Russian troll or not, or if you're really getting genuinely worked up, the best thing you can do is give yourself some space from it. Think a little bit before you share. If you're on a weird website, a good indication, there's a couple good indications of you know, manipulation there. One is, does it have a contact us page? And is it a real physical address with a real phone number, not just a contact us kind of form? Does it have an editorial staff, a masthead that you can look up? Has that author written anything before? And are they similarly incendiary pieces? Is it a monetary operation that's just like a click farm looking for eyeballs on advertising? The way you can find that out is taking a little bit of the text, dropping it into Google and seeing if there are other duplicate websites around the internet, because often they'll have a whole network of those where they share content. Those are actually fairly popular, unfortunately. And then learning how to do that reverse image search is a great thing to do as well when you're kind of wondering about the provenance of a meme or if something has been misattributed potentially. Russia loves to take pictures, for instance, from the Balkan conflicts in the 1990s and attribute them to today in Ukraine. But similar things happen in the US environment too. But I guess the main point I would make is it's not really important whether it's false information coming from Russia or false information coming from a hyper-partisan political actor here in the United States. The ultimate effect is the same, and we all play a part in its amplification. So slow down.
That's such a key point, because I think we're hearing, you know, like for a while and to a large extent still, there's a perception like that this disinformation is something that Russia and those other bad actors are doing to us. But increasingly, people are pointing out that there's actually a convergence in the tactics that we're seeing between democratic and some democratic governments in the way that they're using disinformation and other digital tools to shape political life. And this is where I'm going to transition a little bit to your work on Poland, because in your piece that you posted on this as part of the CNAS series, I mean, it was remarkable. So this was not an issue that I was following closely. And to hear the way that you describe some of the tactics that law and justice are using to shape the recent election were exactly, as you pointed out, tactics that come from the Internet Research Agency itself. So I wonder if you could just give a little bit, maybe some of the top lines from the article that you wrote on Poland, to highlight how we are increasingly seeing some democratic governments employing tools that we have traditionally attributed to more authoritarian governments.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a Polish American, this is a particularly difficult topic for me because I don't like to see this sort of stuff in Poland. And especially, you know, researching disinformation there, Poles often tell me, oh, we're inoculated to Russian disinformation and propaganda. Like, we don't have a problem with Russia. We totally understand. No rose-colored glasses here. We don't need to worry about it. But the problem is they leave themselves vulnerable by using these tactics themselves. So over the past couple of years in Poland, since Law and Justice first gained power in 2015, they have really cracked down on public media. I think that is a key point to make. The public broadcaster that used to be, is still quite popular, in fact. Basically, they fired all the editorial staff there, replaced them with pro-government people, and now it is essentially just a propaganda machine for the Law and Justice Party. In addition to all of that, in a couple of instances, including during the very popular pro-abortion protests a couple of years ago, the Law and Justice Party has used troll farms and bot farms in order to kind of astroturf the internet space and give guise of grassroots support for their policies when in fact, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were out protesting on the streets. They've done similar stuff during election periods. And in this election in particular, we saw the public broadcaster along with official accounts from Law and Justice sharing false narratives about LGBT people in Poland, which of course is, again, one of these big societal fissures in Poland, a very traditional Catholic country. And in addition to all of that, you know, there's this incongruence, that the same thing I was talking about before with the Trump administration's policy between what they say about Russia and say, you know, disinformation is bad when Russia does it, but it's okay when we do it. And that, of course, leaves them more vulnerable. They've also tried to do some kind of societal education efforts through their Ministry of Digitalization. They have kind of a free and fair, truthful elections project, safe elections project, I think it's called. But unfortunately, that ministry has been somewhat politicized. They have a direct link to the Warsaw office of Facebook, and they have a hotline basically for people to report what they call fake news. But usually the reports that go through are ones of conservatives who feel they have been unjustly censored on Facebook, and it's not really looking at other issues of free speech. So the free speech environment there is absolutely contracting. We're seeing the same use of tactics that, you know, disinformers, adversaries have used, including Poland's main adversary, Russia. And as I like to say, you know, disinformation has become democratized now. All you really need is a social media account and sometimes a credit card. You don't even necessarily need that if you know what you're doing and how to use the endemic infrastructure of these platforms to target your messages to the people that are going to be most vulnerable to them.
What do you predict and expect for what this will look like in Duda's next term? I mean, he has a few more years now, has harnessed some power. Is this going to evolve in similar ways to the Kremlin's disinformation tactics? Or are we going to see something a little bit different in Poland?
I mean, I think they're going to continue doubling down on these efforts because they've worked for them so far, and, you know, in conjunction with their pro-family kind of populist economic policies, these things seem to resonate with Poles. And unless we see this coalition of democracies that I was talking about before really stepping up and making a commitment against the use of disinformation, of deep fakes, of hacked information in political campaigning, then I think we're going to see this deterioration, not just in Poland, where it benefits law and justice, but in other places too. I mean, Hungary already has a similar environment going on. In the book, I also cover the Republic of Georgia, which although, you know, the Georgian Dream Party, you could say that they are definitely meddling in the free media in Georgia. That influence is more through cultural vectors, but still a similar pattern. I think we're going to see this in a lot more places unless we have some leadership from countries that are really committed to these values, those values that, you know, democracy runs on, not just the truth, but freedom of expression and trust in our democratic institutions, which ultimately disinformation is trying to undermine.
So you've already touched on bits and pieces of this question already as we've been talking, but like if we started to chart out a roadmap to try to address these issues, and if we wanted to do it in a transatlantic context, where would you start? Is there low hanging fruit? I mean, part of the reason it seems that this has been such a difficult challenge is because it's so all encompassing. Because it gets at the very fissures within our own society for which there are obviously not easy fixes. So it often feels like an insurmountable challenge, and it's difficult to even know how to begin to address it. But like as you've said, Europe has done a much better job in getting the ball rolling. So if you were going to kind of outline a couple of things that you think Europe has done that would work well in the US context, what would you flag?
Well, the obvious one that I've already touched on a couple times is the investment in resilience building. And again, I get a lot of bristling here in the United States when I talk about that. I think people don't think it can work in the federal context, and I think that's nonsense. There are a lot of avenues through which the federal government can provide the funds necessary for states to implement a nonpartisan media literacy and digital literacy curriculum, not only in schools, but for voting age populations. One way that they can do that is through the federal government itself, as, you know, every federal employee needs to take IT security seminars and blah, 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 lots of continuing education. The Czech Republic, Poland, and Ukraine, if I'm not mistaken, of the countries that I profile in the book, have all invested in training their civil servants about what disinformation is, how to recognize it, and how to protect your own personal information when, you know, as a government employee, because you're a target, right? That's all really important. So that's one easy way to start. But on the transatlantic level, I think there are a few institutions that are working on these things. The United States, for some reason, is not very supportive of them, I would say. We could definitely be more robust in that. So there's a center of excellence in Riga for the NATO STRATCOM unit there. And we have not seconded someone there yet. That would be an easy win. We need to coordinate with our EU partners who are regulating on these issues. The UK has also done some really great work toward regulation. I don't want to see a fragmented internet. So I think the more that we can work with, you know, freedom of speech and democratic ideals in mind with our European partners to create a regulatory environment that keeps those at heart. That's very important. And then, you know, working with our European partners as well to impose costs on Russia, because I don't have to tell this group that, you know, every 6 months when Russian sanctions come up for renewal in the EU, there's always a debate about it. And together, those sanctions can have a much greater impact if, you know, we are instituting them for A, a longer period of time, but B, we really have the full force of the transatlantic community behind them. And I think that can be done through the EU, through NATO, certainly between the US and UK, since our poor British friends have now decided to to leave. And I think all of that is really important and certainly something that this administration has not invested in. We've kind of been going it alone. And I think American leadership and cooperation, support for efforts that are already going on is really, really important.
I think I like how you have framed the importance of resilience, because it's not just Russia, as you've mentioned. And one of the things that is more top of mind for Europeans in particular is the way that China has entered the space and the way that their tactics increasingly resemble what we see from the Kremlin in terms of more willing to do some of the disinformation campaigns, kind of conspiracy theories and other things. And I wonder, I know your research didn't focus necessarily on what China was doing, but I wonder how you think about the convergence of these two actors, and what, as you're looking at the space, kind of what you might expect from China moving forward, both in the United States, but also in Europe.
Mm-hmm. I actually have a paper that I wrote with a UK colleague in Parameters, the US Army War College's quarterly. So it's on China and Russia. And what we said is that, you know, this is clearly the new normal. This is a persistent information operation, persistent information competition. And what we need in response is enduring information vigilance. And that needs to be on all sectors in all, basically all the time, because that's how Russia and China operate. It's not just about the information space. We know that they also operate through cultural organizations, through financial influence, and in the criminal sector as well. What I think is interesting about Russia versus China in terms of the goals, especially recently during the COVID-19 pandemic, I still think China is kind of operating, even though they're, I would say, kind of having a renaissance or perhaps just a birth of their overt propaganda tactics on things like Twitter with their officials and, you know, official propaganda outlets creating Twitter accounts and becoming more active there. I still think the goals are more old school propaganda. It's about promoting a positive image of China, about you know, praising China's COVID response, denigrating the US response, whereas we see, you know, Russia on several different sides of any given issue, whether it's on the left, you know, splitting the Democrats into, or on the right, promoting President Trump, promoting, you know, the NRA, whatever it is. It's a bit more varied, a bit more sophisticated for Russia. And China, I think, is absolutely capable of that. We've seen them do that sort of stuff in their domestic space, but it's not yet quite made its way out beyond China's borders. And we're still seeing, you know, fairly traditional propaganda in the form of, you know, big flashy aid deliveries and things like that. But it's definitely something to watch out for. I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before the Tencent army is turned on the rest of the world. And then we're really going to be in a lot of trouble if we haven't built up that resilience before then.
Well, you know, you've touched a little bit on this, but are there some characteristics that differentiate between a Russian bit of disinformation that might pop up on your screen versus a Chinese one? I mean, you gave a great description on how you can tell if it's something coming out of Russia. But is there something that in fact differentiates what the Russians would talk about and their themes and their approach versus how a Chinese effort would look?
Yeah, so from what I've seen, and this is with a giant caveat that I don't speak Chinese, and I feel like that's very important to put out there. From what I've seen from the tweets that have been taken down, for instance, around China's activities with the Hong Kong protests, especially, it was all very blatantly pro-China. With Russia, they can even share things that are anti-Putin sometimes, even on networks like RT, although it's rare. But with the Chinese disinformation that I've seen, it's kind of bumbling. It's now with the COVID pandemic, it's coming from almost all official accounts as part of wolf warrior diplomacy, right? So we're seeing it coming from their diplomats and other official figures. So it's not like it's inauthentic in the same way that Russian disinformation has been, and where they do invest in the inauthentic space. Those pieces of content don't seem to get a lot of traction, don't seem to get a lot of engagement because they are kind of blatantly, obviously pro-Chinese, and kind of it's like they're banging users over the head with like, this is the narrative, rather than, you know, something more surreptitious as Russia has done in the past.
So it's clear that Moscow and Beijing are really trying to export the authoritarian model around the globe. I mean, how are we seeing that play out in the disinformation space? Are we seeing not only countries mimicking their tactics, but actually either Russia or China providing training institutes, you know, evidence of direct transfer of this knowledge between, in particular, those actors and maybe democracies or illiberal regimes, hybrid regimes around the world?
That's a good question. I'm not personally aware of any of that. And I still think, you know, even in these places where we're seeing some slippage in the information space, like Poland and Georgia, obviously they're not going to take, you know, information coordination lessons from Moscow. That being said, I don't think you necessarily need to go to Russia or China to understand how to manipulate information online and manipulate people's emotions. As I said before, like these tactics they're not even uniquely Russian. Necessarily. They are things that PR professionals use sometimes, which is kind of icky to think about. They're certainly tactics that political campaigns have used. And that's part of the problem in our regulatory framework here, and in a couple of other countries as well. You know, we haven't even passed the Honest Ads Act yet. It's been in Congress for almost the entire Trump term. It has bipartisan support. And all it would do is impose the same regulations on online ads that we have on radio, TV, and print. And yet we don't have that, which leaves open a huge loophole, not just for foreign disinformers who want to influence us, but for the domestic ones as well, because people don't have the same information necessary to make the informed choice that they need to around an election. And of course, you know, the platforms are for the most part instituting this on their own, but there's no oversight or transparency into how they're doing it. And we just have to take, you know, Facebook and Google at their word. Twitter, of course, has now stopped taking ads for political purposes. I think we need some sort of ombudsman that's going to be enforcing these rules. And there's much more to do even beyond the Honest Ads Act. So regardless of where people are picking up these tactics, they're very troubling. And we have a giant regulatory chasm that they're all trying to fill.
This has been so helpful. I mean, it's such an important point because there are instances, I think, between Russia and China where even if they're not overtly coordinated, clearly they're complementary and we do see them
Up
on each other. So at least if it's not a proactive sharing of best practices, there is some extent of emulation.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's clear that this playbook works. It was cracked open in 2016. The return on investment, as I said before, is huge for the very little amount of human and monetary resources that, you know, adversaries need to sink into this sort of thing. I think everybody's going to be investing in it, and you don't need to be a genius to do it.
Yep. And so I think it then raises the imperative to bring us back kind of to some of our earlier stuff. If they are coordinating and learning best practices, then the United States and Europeans need to be doing the same thing, right?
Yeah, 100%.
There's a huge, as you've said, there's so much work to be done on this front. And if we can learn from what Europe has done, we would find ourselves, I think, in a much better place than we are now. So I think we'll wrap on a slightly more optimistic note, at least like identifying that this is a significant challenge, that it's a shared challenge between the United States and Europe, and that there are lessons that can be drawn from that would get us to a better place than we are now. The one thing I do want to flag for some of our listeners is if you enjoy Brussels sprouts and you want to hear more stories through a European lens, you can check out a different website, Bear Radio. So it's BEAR.org, and it's Berlin's English language podcasting network. And they have tons of incredible shows. And one of our favorites that would get at more stories like we've had today with Nina is Stories from the Eastern West, which is all about little known histories from Central and Eastern Europe. So if you're interested in getting more on the region, we'd point you in that direction. But again, Nina, thanks so much. This is so timely. It's such an important issue. And the hope is certainly if there is a change in administration next year that we will have a leader at the top who recognizes the importance of the issue, that will hopefully address it in a non-politicized way and then put us on the path to taking some of these, I mean, some of these steps are low-hanging, as you've highlighted, some early low-hanging steps to get us in a better place and then to begin to do the harder work that will be required. But it, I mean, just knowing from government, it is an overwhelming issue. It's hard to know where to sink your teeth into it, but it's gotta be tackled. So thank you for your work on your book, for highlighting some of these really important opportunities, for helping share best practices across European and US constituencies. And so thanks for all of your work, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was great to be with you. Thanks for having me.